Welcome to the first in a series of educational events exploring what's happening with Fukushima and the exponentially increasing radioactivity in our oceans and biosphere, and what we can do about it. We intend to continue these events exploring this issue with other scientists and analysts in the coming months. And we're all here because we love the ocean and our exquisitely beautiful biosphere, and we want to protect it, as I know all of you do. So I want to first honor and appreciate Bing Gong. Bing, can you stand up? Yeah. As you all know, what a great organizer he is, and he's also the fundraiser for our ocean sampling project. And Tom Beatty, are you here, Tom? Yay! Tom is the collector of that ocean sample that's sent to Ken. And we're going to hear more about that ocean sampling project later. And are Steve and Kate here? Our co-sponsors from the Point Reyes? Yay, Steve, stand up. Thank you. We really appreciate your leadership in our community, Steve. Thank you so much. And also, our stalwart co-sponsor, the Fukushima Response, based in Sonoma County, who's famous. Where are you, John? Oh, he's up in the loft there. Fukushima Response is famous for organizing. Fukushima's here on the beach in San Francisco with 500 people who spelled that out with their bodies. And also that was joined in by multiple events in other parts of the world at the same time. We're also pleased to say that Fukushima response team is doing a citizen monitoring project, and we hope to hear more about that later on. And they're working with Dan Seith from International MedCom in Sebastopol. Dan, would you like to stand up? And they're doing regional monitoring of water, air, food, and soil samples. And Dan's helped develop the citizen monitoring networks around Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and also is a founding member of SafeCast, which is doing such extensive monitoring work in Japan since Fukushima. And we also want to acknowledge our organization, the Ecological Options Network. Thank you. Jim, my partner. And we've worked on this issue for 30 years. We started out with a PBS documentary that was broadcast nationally and internationally, and we've just kept on all these years. And we are so pleased and honored to be in conversation tonight with two eminent scientists who are, against all odds, doing precious work, amassing data necessary to gauge and indicate what might be happening as a result of the radioactivity released and continuing to be released, not only from Fukushima, but from elsewhere. And so the truth is, we are being very balanced here. We have one scientist who's attacked by the pro-nuclear people, and we have one scientist who's attacked by the anti-nuclear people. So we're giving a very balanced account. Right. So the truth is that we need all the measurements we can get and all the studies. Yet the governments and agencies are not providing funding to the scientists, nor information to the people. Now, why is that? Who can imagine? So we need these scientific markers because we don't want to be either overly alarmed or overly complacent, and neither panicked nor dismissive. And this is a reality. We've got a constant buildup of radioactivity going on here. So is the ocean safe for our children to surf in? Is the seafood safe to eat? And what can we do to help the people in Japan, and what can the people in Japan do to protect themselves? And what can we do here? So we're so happy to be able to have this conversation tonight with these brilliant men and all of you here. Thank you. So I'm going to introduce Dr. Bissler, who is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and who specializes in the study of natural and man-made radionuclides in the ocean. His work includes studies of fallout from atmospheric nuclear weapons testing, assessments of Chernobyl impacts on the Black Sea, and examination of radionuclide contaminants in the Pacific resulting from Fukushima nuclear power plants. Dr. Bissler has served as chair of the Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry Department at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, as executive scientist of the U.S. Joint Global Ocean Fluxes Planning and Data Management Office, and 2 years as an associate program director at the U.S. National Science Foundation Chemical Oceanography Program. In 2009, he was elected Fellow of the American Geophysical Union, and in 2011, he was noted as the top-cited ocean scientist by the Times Higher Education for the decade 2000 to 2010. He is currently director of the new Center for Marine and Environmental Radioactivity at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And you can get more information at his Cafe Thorium website. So thank you so much, Ken, for being here.
Thank you for that introduction, and Bing and everyone for putting this on, and all of you for coming here tonight, because it really, your interest is what motivated me to step back as my research science makes me, you know, study these kinds of things and talk to people about what it all means to have a little cesium, a lot of cesium in the ocean. What does that mean for us and for you? And it's your interest that brought me here today. From Woods Hole is outside of Boston. We're independent, we're not-for-profit, about 800 people work there. It's quite a large place, and we exist on mostly government grants or private foundation funding. But the story I want to tell, and we'll hopefully have time for a lot of questions, is going to start with a little history. What did it look like near Japan before Fukushima? That's what that image is supposed to show you. What happened in 2011 in March at the events of Fukushima Daiichi? That's an aerial photograph of some of the explosions at those reactors. Where would that nuclear material, those contaminants, be moving with the ocean currents? How quickly would they reach our shoreline? That led to this crowd-funded campaign, ourradioactiveocean.org, where people like Bing got their friends and groups together to help me sample, and analyze, pay for those analyses. And then I'll end with something that's kind of new for me, is making it easier so everybody could wear something to actually collect samples, get more data, because I'm very much a scientist who wants to see what the numbers are. So, what are the numbers? So we're going to go back in time to 1960, 59 to 61, and just to remind you, in the ocean at Scripps Pier, this is La Jolla near San Diego, people were already monitoring the levels of cesium-137, a byproduct of the atmospheric nuclear testing that was going on, starting, you know, with World War II and beyond. And these are the levels going up and down, very frequent measurements. I'm a little jealous when I see how many numbers they have. And forget the units. But we'll remember this number 8 because I'll be using that unit later on to show you how much is off your coast. But back in the 60s, we had levels that went up to 8 of these becquerels per cubic meter, so 8. We're measuring there now in 2014, seeing numbers around 2. So our coastline, specifically the West Coast, has seen higher levels back in the 60s than what we're detecting today from the additional cesium coming from Japan or what's in the ocean as residual from that time. So every time you go in the ocean, you're already swimming in waters that have some of these isotopes in them. How big was the testing compared to, say, Chernobyl and Fukushima? And I'll talk mostly about cesium-137. I'll tell you more about other isotopes later. But 1,000 petabecquerels, that's a number with 10 to the 15 zeros. That's a very big number. It's a very small unit. It's like measuring distance in millimeters instead of miles. But it is about 1,000 of those units were released for cesium in the primarily 50s and 60s. Most of it's in the ocean because we live on an ocean planet. Chernobyl was about 10 times smaller. Most of that fell on land. This was 1986, some 25 years before Fukushima. We have more uncertainty in the Fukushima numbers because we didn't have very good measurements. A lot of the radioactivity drifted over the ocean. That's good news for Japan, but much harder to analyze what's there. So we have numbers that range typically smaller than the total from Chernobyl. I tell people it's comparable. As an oceanographer, what strikes me is more of it went directly into the ocean itself. And so for the oceans, this was unprecedented. As an accidental release, this is much larger than Chernobyl for the oceans. By the way, Three Mile Island was a very, very small in comparison. Okay. I'll just do very quickly, kind of reminding you what happened. We all saw the pictures, the devastation of the tsunami that caused the power outage that led to the overheating and then explosions at Fukushima Daiichi on the coastline. The first thing we saw were those explosions coming off, gases coming out, volatile, so things when they get hot become vaporized, put into the atmosphere, and that's what we call fallout. About 80% of that fell into the ocean. Thankfully, it didn't blow mostly to Tokyo. The highest levels on land are kind of in the north and in the west, but most of it fell in the ocean. And that would have been shortly after, a few days after the overheating in mid-March. They also took heroic efforts to keep these reactors cool so they didn't get any worse. And they did that by putting water on these reactors and trying to cool them down. Even though they shut down the fission process itself in the reactors, there's still a lot of heat left behind from all the radioactive materials. And that requires cooling water, whether you're producing electricity or not. And we call that this direct discharge. That actually peaked a little bit later, and I'll show you some data in the next slide. But basically, you're putting water on a reactor, buildings, that's becoming more contaminated, that water, as it seeps through them and goes back in the ocean because you're right on the coast. Now, fallout, some of it did land on land, and that comes back down through rivers. A very small amount compared to what was put in the ocean then, but it continues to this day, and scientists in Japan and others are monitoring that. And then work that I do as well is groundwater flow. So we're taking samples on the beaches north and south and looking at what's coming down underneath the ground as a groundwater input, which is also a continuous source of these isotopes back to the ocean. So as an oceanographer, these are the four things I care about. So I've got a couple of graphs. This one I think is quite informative, and so I'll walk you through it. Every red dot is an ocean sample. Someone went out, grabbed some ocean water as close as they could get to Fukushima Daiichi, basically the docks, the waters right next to those reactors. And this is 2011 in April. This was March 11th. They started sampling a couple weeks after. These units, it's this becquerel, it's this decay event per second in a cubic meter of water. A cubic meter of water is 260 gallons. It's a very small unit, a big amount of water. The number that they were seeing off Japan, and actually here today, I'll give you a little bit of an idea already, it's about one or two of those units. The numbers I saw coming out of Japan started at 10,000, went up to 50 million by April 6th. The highest we'd ever seen after Chernobyl were about 1,000. So this is when we were getting worried. This is when we were flying down to Washington, D.C., saying we've got to do something. These levels for marine biota, if you're swimming or living in those, can cause mortality, reproductive effects, things that were easy to see. And these levels actually could be reduced quite quickly by basically plugging holes in all of those buildings. They had basements that actually, if you remember some of the images, had what looked like a fire hose of radioactive water just going into the ocean. So if you start plugging your big leaks, this should go down. That's the blue line. It should go down back to here quite quickly unless you have continued releases. And so from the start, as soon as we saw here in June, which is the first time I went over there, levels that were elevated, we knew there was an ongoing source as well. But oops, too fast. Let's put these a little bit in perspective, and one reason why there's some confusion is they have an operating limit of about 60 to 70,000 becquerels per cubic meter, well above any country's, that's our U.S. drinking water limit, 7,400. And so by some standards, these waters were, this is one word I don't like to use, I'll say it now, safe. They were considered okay because we got below the reactor limits. Abe, the prime minister, is saying everything's under control, it's not leaking. Well, it was leaking, it still is. The number today, I'm going back in a few weeks, will be somewhere between 100 and 1,000. And at these levels, there's still a concern for seafood. Consuming and internalizing cesium is a much greater health hazard than just swimming in the ocean with a little bit of cesium in it like we all do all the time. So I'll show you some fish data, but this is how bad things got, and that's when we really knew we had to be there. Never seen anything like it. So I think I'm going to repeat that. When we're in the tens of millions, I'm going to be directly worried about impacts on the marine biota. Thousands, tens of thousands, I'm going to be concerned about eating that seafood. And down in here, I'm not as concerned. That's similar to what we see today already in the ocean for these isotopes. So at those levels in 2011, they measured cesium. Now this is total cesium in fish, that same becquerel unit per kilogram, 2 pounds of fish. And they measured it over time. And this is, again, when they were saying they had stopped the leaks, it's under control. They had already, though, closed down these fisheries along the coast of Japan. Fukushima Daiichi is down there in the red area. And the numbers were not going down. The only way you can have fish remain high in cesium is to keep introducing cesium into the ocean. And so it's kind of interesting. What I've shown you so far, these red dots, these are all Japanese data. But what we did, what I did, was took some of those numbers and put them in some sort of a usable form. Someone asked me over dinner tonight, you know, were the Japanese allowed to say these things? I don't know people who lost their jobs, but they were told not to publish information like this. This data came to me from a colleague in Japan who could not be co-author on the paper. He worked for the fisheries department, and he provided these information so I could put it in a form like this to say, look, the numbers, half of them were above this limit of 100 that Japan had set by 2012, and it was good reason to keep those fisheries closed. And to this day, several of the fisheries are closed, even though this has gotten much, much better. And I'll show some numbers later to see how low it is today. But clearly, ongoing sources. Again, every red dot is a fish sample now, not a water sample. And lots of variations from 10 of these units up to 10,000. And I'll show some higher numbers later. So that's Japan. So what does the ocean do? Some beautiful things, actually. This is a model from satellite data made by NASA of ocean currents. And all of these white lines show you the direction and velocity of water moving off Japan with the Kuroshio current. I live on the East Coast. We have the Gulf Stream. This is the Gulf Stream of the Pacific. And it moves water very quickly out into the ocean. So anything you put in the ocean here, debris, other things are going to move with these currents. So what you can also do is model the isotopes of cesium. These move with those currents and predict how far they're going to get, how fast, and how much is going to be in the ocean. So you do this kind of model. That one pretty quickly. That's 1 year. it would have made it about halfway across the Pacific. Here's Hawaii, by the way. Most of the isotopes are carried with currents north of Hawaii. They started out in the red here in these tens of thousands. Already, they're much lower, 10 to 100. Late 2013 is when we started a lot of phone calls. I would look at this data and say, well, the numbers here are quite low, but there were no numbers being collected in 2013. And again, low on this scale of, in those waters, it's safe to be there. In tens of thousands, you don't eat the fish, and in the millions, there's direct impacts. 2014, 2015, we expect to see some sign of it up and down the coast. But this is a prediction based upon a model that really takes the entire 5,000 miles and does some very basic assumptions. You know, all models, it's been said, are wrong. Some are useful. This was very useful for us, but it's not the real world. It's a model. So we'll let it go on, and you'll see the numbers are going down. But basically, we were sitting there in the end of 2013. I had only worked near Japan. I hadn't thought about the west coast of North America. A lot of people were concerned. We wanted to address that concern and collect samples, and that's how we started this ourradioactiveocean.org. That's the motivation behind this citizen scientist, because people actually collect the samples for us and crowdfunded, because we need about $550 for every sample to measure cesium at these extremely low levels. You can't wave a Geiger counter over it and quickly analyze. You need the specific techniques that we were doing back in Chernobyl, back before then, to look at the residual amount that was already in the ocean. So we introduce this, and we'll hear maybe a little bit more about it from Bing, but we can propose locations. You can view those results. As soon as we get them, we put them up. The fun part for me, I'll go through a couple of pictures, and I'll show you what that map is, but you know, we get people involved. This is right here at Point Reyes, some of our first sample collectors. There's a 5-gallon container that we have to fill up to analyze it. Here's another example of a surfing group in Santa Cruz that got together and had a fundraiser as part of a local radio station. You know, I'm a research scientist. I usually do these things myself on very expensive equipment with machines. These people just got out there, made an event out of it, tried to learn something about how the ocean works in their area. Classroom here, La Colinas Junior High School in Santa Barbara, took a sample for us. Again, a pretty big sample, but relatively easy to do. So that's been happening now everywhere from San Diego up to Alaska, Bering Sea, and out in Hawaii. I'm plotting now by color. White is or yellow is the location of all of these samples. We've been very successful. We have about 60 sites now and 100 samples in this year and a half of existence. We have most of the citizen sampling for us along the shore and a couple of research cruises where we collected water and then used that crowdfunding support to actually analyze them. Yellow is where we've seen 134 cesium. I've talked mostly about the one that's still here from the weapons testing era. Cesium 137 has what's called a 30-year half-life. It sticks around for decades before it decays away. Another radioactive form of cesium has a 2-year half-life, and the only place you could find that would be from something recent like Fukushima. And the levels, you probably can't read that number. It says very low. It's less than 2 of these becquerels. That number we saw off Scripps was 2. Fortunately, what we've seen, and this is a very new number down here off San Diego, a couple of times up here in British Columbia, one that's so new I got on the plane somewhere off of 50 miles off of Seattle, we found another dot that's about 2 of these units. We're starting to see the penetration of cesium from offshore, these are all offshore samples, to these coastal sites, but at levels that agree with those light blue colors on the model, something like 2 in these units. We did one comparison. I'm not going to say this is zero. You know, we can always detect small amounts of cesium-137 in every single sample, so that's what we swim in. But if you get up to numbers like 10, we're talking about an amount that the risk from swimming is something like every day in an ocean at 10 would be 1,000 times less than the single dental x-ray you choose to take. It's not zero, but it's not what concerns me when it was 10 million off Japan or 10,000 when the fisheries were closed. These are the numbers we're seeing. We have a couple numbers from Point Reyes and Bodega Head here in the last month. All of them showed less than 0.2 for the 134 cesium, and so we can't detect it, and very low amounts, about 1.5 to 2 of the 137. That's what we've seen all along, even before Fukushima. I also want to point out that we're not the only ones doing this. This is from a Canadian lab. They had some cruises offshore. This is back to 137 cesium, but this number here is 5. I mentioned 10 because we've kind of doubled the highest number we've measured offshore. And we see it primarily offshore, a little bit of mixing here, near shore. That's some of our data, same kind of map. One thing, just in case people have followed some of the news about odd temperatures in the ocean, there is an anomaly. There's warm water. This is temperature over here, the same part of the coastline, trying to line it up. And what we see is that there's warm water offshore that's not mixing into the cold water near shore. And that's probably what's kind of the same physical processes. These ocean currents are keeping the cesium-137 and 134 offshore. So these are consistent with each other and coming from completely different data sets than what I just showed you. Cesium offshore and ocean currents that are maintaining anomalously warm waters offshore. It's been called the blob if you've been following some of the news, but little mixing. Kelp Watch, some of you even participate, I heard today, in Kelp Watch. They have sites at the locations here. The colors just indicate which year they sampled. I believe they don't see any of the 134 cesium in their samples at this point. They have 48 sites and about 52 scientists using kelp as a way to integrate the signal. It's like a sponge, right? So you can go back and look at the kelp. So on our coastline, I haven't showed you any fish data, so I just want to contrast the cesium in fish near Japan, these three bars here. The bottom-dwelling fish are what I showed you before, near 100 of these becquerels. Salmon and tuna have always been lower. We think it's because of exposure on the seafloor to higher levels. When those tuna, for example, swim to San Diego in 2011, we saw for the first time 134, the isotope from Fukushima, at about 10 or 12 in all of those tuna, not in 2008. But the gray bar you probably can't see is there's always some cesium in everything that swims in the ocean, 137, that legacy cesium at levels of a few of these units. So whether we're talking about tuna or salmon, we're talking about levels that are even there today for things that feed off Japan and swim across. Japan has the world's strictest limit for the amount that's allowed in seafood that made them close the fisheries here. Our limit is 1,200, 10 times higher. When I first went to Japan, the Japanese limit would have been up here at 500. They lowered it because they wanted to increase public confidence in seafood safety. It wasn't based upon new data. It was based upon the idea that lower is better. I think people might agree. But there wasn't new data to support that. And they eat easily twice as much fish as we do, so 500 made relatively good sense. But to this day, they're sticking with 100, and most of their fish are falling below that if you look out in 2014 and 15. In Canada, there are headlines, though, right at the power plant. The highest number I've seen is 7,600. You probably don't want to eat that. It's kind of an ugly-looking fish anyway. But so within the arms of this reactor, where there still is an ongoing leak, you do find some hot spots. And that's been the real dilemma, is when can you open up fisheries when you find unique fish that are that high. And by the way, they set limits so that you would have to be eating above that limit every day to receive a dose that the health officials consider significant. One fish usually doesn't cause something that can be observed in human consumers anyway at all. But you have to set limits, and that's what they've done. The other thing, oh boy, well, that's the coastline. That's why I'm trying to stand up. Here's Vancouver down here. Can I see it better? Oh, yeah, I can. Noose River. So these are salmon and steelhead trout from a group called Inform in Canada. And they've been analyzing these last couple of years. This is 2014 data, the most recent I could get, the amount of cesium in fish along our coastline. People ask me, why don't I analyze fish? Well, that's not something I'm trained to do. I could do it, but if we don't see it in the water, I don't expect to see it in the local fish populations. Some of these salmon do migrate. They're using a color scheme here, so if it's green on the top, like they all are, there's less than one of the units of 137 cesium that's in every fish. And if it's blue on their belly, which they all are, they're not yet detecting any of the 134 in salmon up and down British Columbia from Victoria, Canada, up the coastline. So these are data. We've heard a lot in the news about trying to link health effects and marine biota. Starfish wasting is one of the ones that got the most press. People immediately started to make links between what might be happening. And it's certainly of concern. There have been, since then, viruses that have been identified as being the major cause of the wasting disease and mortality, not something that we can attribute to radioactivity per se. There have been beached mammals, whales. This is an example, April of this year. They went out and analyzed for cesium and couldn't detect the 134 isotope in them. So I think my opinion, I'm not a radioecologist, I measure what's in the water, but the levels in the water are too low to cause something that you could measure directly in terms of our side of the ocean, not what was happening in Japan. But it's also very difficult, as we'll probably hear from Tim, to link cause and effect with multiple stressors. We have climate change stressors, we have plastics, we have other pollutants, things causing stress on these animals. But we don't see anything in the water that would make me alarmed about our coast. And if we did, it would be much worse on the Japanese coast, and they're also not observing in the ocean massive die-offs, for example, of starfish. So I think we have some hope there. I'm getting near the end. I've talked about a lot of things, but mostly about cesium, so why just cesium? There's a whole alphabet soup of isotopes, some of which are much more dangerous to us. We're focusing a lot on strontium-90. So what I tried to do for this talk, forget the units, 2011, the amount of some of these isotopes was much higher than cesium. These are the ones that decay quite quickly, so they have larger health effects as they decay. That's the process that would cause a health effect. Iodine-131, 8-day half-life, causes health effects because of accumulation in particularly children's thyroids. But it's gone by 2015. The only ones left, krypton is a gas that disperses quite widely. Cesium isotopes that we've been talking about, strontium-90, 30-year half-life, that I believe is of more concern these days. It's a logarithmic scale, a million times smaller amounts of plutonium, which is of concern, but nothing, in fact, that is higher than what was there already from those weapons testing. This was not a large source of plutonium, despite some reports to the contrary. That's based upon Japanese data, my data, and understanding what physically happened. The core remained intact. It's water going through the core, gases and things getting out that were the main source. That's consistent with these data here. So it's not just cesium, but if we don't see cesium, we don't expect to see these other isotopes. So ending here, you know, this was unprecedented for the ocean. The impacts will always be greater, closer to the source. That sounds obvious, but I think people forget that. Anything we attribute as an effect here should be much worse in Japan. And certainly, as we'll hear, the effects are starting to be seen on land much easier. It will cross the Pacific, but I think the levels will be not zero, but similar to what we saw in the 1960s during weapons testing. And what do I lose sleep over? The continued ongoing leaks are a growing concern for strontium-90, something that is retained longer in fish bones than our bones because it substitutes for calcium, something that's in your system. And I keep saying, you know, you can't just measure those tens of thousands of fish. You have to look at the oceans, the rivers, the biota, come up with new ways. And certainly the decommissioning, the costs, safety costs, the decades, and those poor 100,000-plus people who can't move back to their homes is a huge loss in Japan, culturally, financially, closed fisheries in a country like that. Finally, you know, I still believe we need more data, so we're trying to work on ways to make it easier to collect a sample. So instead of asking you to get 50 pounds, 5 gallons of water, we've got this cute new device. It's working. It's going to be working and tested on something that's also phenomenal attempt that will be made by a person named Ben LeCompte. I almost hung up on him, but I read that he actually has swam across the Atlantic, and the way you do these types of swims is you go in your wetsuit 8 hours a day, get on your support boat, it's called a stage swim, go back in the water. He did that for almost 3 months. It's going to take him 6 months in his wetsuit with a much larger support ship to get 5,000 miles from Tokyo to San Francisco, and he's going to be wearing this device and collecting samples, not just for radioactivity, but for plastic. So it's a platform. He really wants to just teach people about oceans and what's going on. And we're looking right now for sponsors, both for those samples that'll be on our website, Our Radioactive Ocean, and really to bring this from this one 3D printer version to the masses so people could wear this up and down the coastline, get on your phone, surf's up, cesium's down, you know, that kind of information would be quite useful, right? People want to know, and let's make it easier for them to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. So I'm pleased to introduce Timothy Mousseau. Timothy is a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. His former positions include Associate Vice President for Research and Dean of the Graduate School at USC and Program Officer for Population Biology at the U.S. National Science Foundation. He recently served on a National Academy of Science committee to examine health hazards related to nuclear power plant operations, including San Onofre, right? Mm-hmm. Which is in Southern California and just shut down. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the Explorers Club, New York City, and is an elected member of the Cosmos Club, Washington, D.C. His research is concerned with the ecology and evolution of animals and plants, with a special interest in how adaptations to changing environments evolve in natural populations and the evolution of adaptive maternal effects. Since 2000, he and his colleagues have studied the impacts of radioactive fallout from the Chernobyl disaster on natural populations of birds, insects, plants, and microbes, with more than 70 scientific publications on this topic since 2005, and 10 books and edited volumes and more than 180 scientific publications in total. More recently, he's traveled to Fukushima to study the impacts of the high radiation levels found in this region. His research has been featured in the New York Times, The Economist, Scientific American, BBC, and CBS's 60 Minutes. So we welcome you. Thank you so much for being here, Tim.
Thank you. Swapping out computers. Mac to PC, PC to Mac. Really, really is a great privilege and honor to be here tonight. I want to thank Mary Beth and the rest of the organizers for inviting me and you for sharing this evening. I used to live in Davis, California, and so it's really, and I used to do some field work here when I was working there, and I haven't been back in about 25 years, so it really is special to have this chance. All right. That's not my talk, but yeah. And I did want to also mention that it really is an honor to be sharing the stage with Ken Bissler from Woods Hole, certainly one of the world's premier oceanographic institutions, and Ken's just doing a fantastic job of setting up these surveillance programs. Really the only person who's doing it, and I really applaud his efforts. I really do. All right. I think we're ready to go. Okay. Well, so tonight, my job is to share with you some of the work that we've been doing in Chernobyl and since about 2000 in Fukushima more recently, two huge events. And, you know, up until a few years ago, I used to get the question all the time, why are you working in Chernobyl? Why are you bothering to study the effects of the Chernobyl disaster? And the reason people were asking me this is because everybody thought it was a unique event. It was unique to the former Soviet Union. It was unique to their management style, their engineering. It could never happen again, right? And of course, Fukushima proved that that isn't the case. And in fact, if you really want to know why we should be doing a lot more research in this area, you really only have to look very, very superficially at the history of nuclear power. Essentially, there have been about 600 reactors, plus or minus, since the beginning of time, and currently about 430 around the world in 31 countries, about 100 here in the U.S., plus or minus. We've got a bunch of new ones under construction around the world. There's four new reactors being built within 60 miles of my house in South Carolina right now. I'm not kidding you. And so, you know, nuclear is not going away. No matter what you think about nuclear power, it's here for a little while longer, at least in some parts of the world. But in this time, there have been three major accidents at the commercial nuclear power plants. That's a fairly high frequency, really, when you think about it. And there's been plenty more smaller incidents and accidents. And given that most nuclear power plants, most of them are getting older, and many of them nearing the end of their useful lifespan, we're expecting to see more accidents. In fact, there was a recent study published or promoted by MIT not too long ago that suggested that we will see another Chernobyl-scale nuclear accident by the year 2050, and we're likely to see a Three Mile Island-scale event within the next 10 years, based on a much larger data set than had been put together prior to this past year, frequencies of accidents and engineering analyses. So we need to know more. We need to know what the consequences of accidents might be. Here is a little map showing all of the current nuclear power plants in the U.S. Most of them tend to be up here. Look where I live. You know, it's certainly we're a nuclear state, and it's clear that nuclear is here for a little bit longer. Most of these power plants, of course, have huge stockpiles of spent fuel, and that's another issue. Another reason for understanding the effects of radioactivity in the environment is the fact that, and I didn't know this until 5 years ago, really, when I got involved in these National Academy panels, every single nuclear power plant, by design, releases literally tons of nuclear effluent every year. Of course they do. That's how we generate electricity. We're using fission, and the product of fission are these radioactive daughters that have to be dealt with, and most of them are dribbled out into the water or into the air. And of course, as we all know, the solution to pollution is dilution, right? So as long as we can dilute the effluent below these regulatory limits that are rather arbitrarily set, then there's no problem. Well, at least for the power plant companies, they're operating legally if they can do that. But anyway, every nuclear power plant releases lots and lots of radioactivity, but for the most part, we have little knowledge of the environmental impacts of these effluents. Now, of course, we also discovered recently that most of the nuclear power plants out there have illegal releases as well, releases that, you know, that just by accident, of course. And so, we started to pay attention when it was noticed that the Vermont Yankee plant was leaking tritium off-site. And at the time, I was on a National Academy panel where they were asking, so what is the impact of leaking tritium? And we got all together for a couple of days and tried to figure this out and realized that there was insufficient scientific data to really answer the question for Congress. We really had no idea. We didn't think it was good. We didn't think it was a huge problem at this point, because for the most part, the nuclear power plants were only leaking on site. They weren't, for most of them, were not leaking it too far beyond the boundaries of the actual power plant. But in truth, we really didn't know. And that was kind of a wake-up call for a lot of people. But still, to this day, there's not a lot of research going on with respect to radiation or tritium leaks. But we are learning a little bit more every day as people put things together. There was a recent meta-analysis. This is the kind of study where you take a bunch of different studies and put them together and statistically analyze the combined data set. And when you do this for studies done in Europe primarily, epidemiological studies, what we've discovered is that if you are a pregnant woman living within 3 miles of a nuclear power plant, you have about a 100% increase, a doubling increase of the probability of your child getting leukemia. Now, that sounds terrible in one way. It certainly is terrible if your child has leukemia, if you've won the negative lottery, as it were. Luckily, childhood leukemia is a very, very rare disease, so the absolute frequencies of this disease are quite low. But again, it's not a wonderful thing if you're the victim of this kind of contaminant. We need to know more. We had the 60th anniversary this last month of the bombs being dropped on Japan. And most of what we know about the effects of radiation in the environment actually come from the studies of the atomic bomb survivors. Unfortunately, those studies didn't really start till 5, 6, 7 years after the disaster, so we missed a lot of information, or the bombs being dropped, so we missed a lot of information from that. But we have learned a lot. But we didn't actually study the effects on the environment, per se, following the atomic bombs. We have studied the effects on people, but we haven't looked at the animal populations particularly. So another reason, especially given, as Ken mentioned earlier, there have been just an enormous... I had no idea until a few years ago. We were just going crazy back in the 50s and 60s testing atomic bombs. There were 1,193 atmospheric tests conducted around the world. I think about 400 of them by the U.S., maybe a few more than that. Total 2,700 atomic bomb tests. They released, as Ken showed earlier, enormous quantities of radioactivity that still linger at relatively high levels in some parts of the world where the testing was conducted, like the Marshall Islands, parts of the Sahara where the French were testing bombs, and elsewhere. But again, nobody has studied the impacts on the biota in the area. So another reason for doing it. You all live pretty close to Hanford, I think. So I'm sure you're aware of the goings-on the states north of you. The Hanford site, like the Savannah River site, was a place where they were generating, making the plutonium necessary for our bombs. And in the course of generating the plutonium, they generated a huge amount of waste, much of which was put into storage tanks, which are now leaking into the surrounding area, into the river, and potentially causing some serious environmental consequences. We're having to spend an enormous amount of money to deal with it, but we know very little about the environmental consequences of this leaking. Maybe it's not a problem. Right? Maybe it's not a problem. And that's what we've been told. Many of the models suggest that maybe it's not a problem. So we decided, my research team, just completely by accident. I started off as an evolutionary biologist. I'm still an evolutionary biologist. And my motivation and interest in this topic is results from an interest in evolutionary biology. How are natural populations changing, adapting in response to this novel stressor? I used to work on climate change. Now I work on radiation. So we started working in Chernobyl about 15 years ago. Here's a map of the Chernobyl disaster impacts. Again, 200,000 square kilometers significantly impacted with radiation. Most people know about the stuff in Ukraine and Belarus and parts of Russia. Most people don't realize that large swaths of Scandinavia and Central Europe were also significantly contaminated. Here's a map, similar map for terrestrial Japan. Much smaller event from a terrestrial standpoint in terms of landmass contaminated. The Fukushima disaster is on the order of a tenth or less of the Chernobyl disaster. The Chernobyl disaster was just huge in terms of terrestrial impacts. Of course, as you heard earlier, enormous quantities of materials released from Fukushima into the ocean. Their impacts, their biological impacts, largely unknown at this point. So why hasn't there been more investment in basic research associated with these kinds of events? I would argue that in part it's because of the attitudes that have been presented by agencies, intergovernmental agencies in charge of promoting the peaceful use of atomic energy, right? For instance, the IAEA, who suggested in their report from 10 years ago that we had nothing to worry about. In fact, you've probably seen the TV shows that have suggested that the Chernobyl zone is thriving, the animals are doing great because there's a fence and there's no people, and the effects of people are bigger than the effects of radiation. But there were no data presented to support that. There were no scientific studies to support that. And so, I don't know. This report from the International Atomic Energy Agency from the Director General just came out this week relating to Fukushima, and it's largely based on the UNSCAR report that came out last year. It's a complete whitewash. They have not reviewed the literature, is what I'm saying. They have not commissioned any scientific research. They have not paid attention to the scientific research that has been generated in the last 10 years from Chernobyl and the last 4 years from Fukushima. No rigorous empirical scientific data, and they just ignored it. So anyway, in a few years ago, in 2000, just out of casual curiosity, a colleague of mine, Anders Møller, who is a very prominent biologist, we decided to work together on this project, visit Chernobyl, and kind of as a sideline, start looking at some of the birds in Chernobyl and see what was going on with them. We thought it would be a novel, new, creative approach to studying evolutionary processes. And of course, that's been very interesting. We started working together there in July of 2011, so a few months after the disaster in Fukushima. We're mostly interested in, as the physicists say, we're the bird and bunny guys. You know, we're interested in birds and bunnies, and it's kind of derogatory, I know, but it is true. We've been interested in basically the biological endpoints, and we've also been interested in the children, more or less. Made a whole bunch of visits to Chernobyl and Fukushima over the years, and published. We're over 80 papers now. And one thing I did want to mention before I get into some of the negative things I'm going to show you is that, you know, we consider ourselves to be independent scientists. We're not anti-nuclear activists at all. We're simply scientists looking to find new things to see. And let's see. And as scientists, the work that we do is driven by simple hypotheses and questions. And you know, very, very simple logic, straightforward logic is what governs what we do. The first question is simply, are the doses that we see in these areas high enough to cause genetic damage, mutations to the organisms? Pretty simple. If we don't see any evidence of genetic damage, then we don't have to look any further. We don't need to be concerned. Right? Pretty simple. But if we do see genetic damage, that's not enough by itself. Certainly a good hint, but it's not enough. And so the next question is, are there consequences to the shape and size, performance of the organisms as a result of the genetic damage? Are there fitness consequences? Is there any evidence of adaptation? Are there effects leading to population changes in terms of abundances and diversity? And finally, are there ecosystem functioning consequences to that? And that's been the driving force of what we're doing. So what have we found? And I don't have enough time to really go into any detail. I'm going to zip through, hit the highlights. If any of you are interested, I've left a couple of sheets in the back that have a list of some of our publications. Our website has links to most of our papers, and I encourage you to go there. And, of course, you're welcome to ask me any questions you'd like. Right, first thing, start with the mutation stuff, the genetic damage stuff. So we've done all sorts of studies looking for genetic damage in a whole bunch of different ways and a whole bunch of different critters, and other people have as well. This year we published a paper which basically was a meta-analysis. It's one of these analyses of analyses, basically where we take data from all different sources, put it together and analyze it in a combined data set. Gives us a lot more power to look at patterns. And the basic finding was that radiation from Chernobyl causes mutations. Big surprise. It was overwhelming. The size of the effect due to Chernobyl radiation was extremely large. And this is just a frequency plot showing the effect sizes for all of these different studies. Each one of these lines is a different study in sort of radiation versus non-radiation. We had some fairly strict constraints on what would be included. The overwhelming conclusion, and it's no big surprise, radiation causes genetic damage in Chernobyl. So what are the consequences? Does it matter? Maybe, you know, we all have mutations. We all accumulate mutations with every cell division. And in fact, our cells are working as hard as they can to repair the genetic damage that occurs as a normal part of physiology. One of my friend's colleagues told me that with every cell division, there are 50 breaks in the chromosomes that have to be repaired. So radiation is just adding to that. But so maybe there aren't any visible consequences of the added mutational load. Well, there are. Lots and lots. The first thing we noticed, because it was so easy to see, was the fact that many of the birds were showing what we call partial albinism. There are other words for this, other terms for it. Basically, it's some of the cells responsible for pigments are killed as a consequence of the radiation, direct or indirect effects, and this leads to patches of white feathers. Here's a normal barn swallow. Here's one with a big white patch under its chin. This male, it's probably not as affecting his ability to eat or to survive, but it probably is affecting his ability to attract a mate. So he ain't getting any. So his fitness ain't too high. But anyway, it is a marker for the radiation exposure. We don't see these kinds of patches of white feathers anywhere else around the world. I'm going to skip the actual data. You'll have to trust me. It's real. What's really interesting is that 2 years ago, we started finding birds in Fukushima with patches of white feathers as well. And again, the frequencies are increasing. It's related to the radiation exposure to the area. So it seems to be real. I apologize for showing you a cow's ass, but you know, here it is. With white spots, they first started noticing these white spots on these cows shortly after the disaster. I don't think they're very common. Maybe we have some ranchers in the audience. Anybody seen white patches of fur on their cows? Doesn't happen very often. Let's see if this is going to work. We developed a method where we could actually get fresh male genetic material from these birds without hurting them. And this is important because it's a proxy for genetic damage. And of course, males without good, viable sperm have very low fitness as well. And what we learned was that the males that suffered from high radiation and high oxidative stress had very, very poorly performing sperm. We continued this work and noticed that in 9 out of 10 species that we looked at this in great detail, the Chernobyl birds had much higher frequencies of deformed sperm. And a deformed sperm is not a very useful sperm. And so, again, very strong indications of negative consequences. This one was even more interesting. We realized when we started catching birds in the most contaminated areas that in some of these really hotter areas, 39% in this year of the male birds were completely sterile. They had no sperm or just a few dead sperm. So clearly not a good thing. Not surprising, right? If you read the medical literature, you would know that, those folks, males undergoing radiation therapy for cancer, prostate cancer, for instance, are, and if they're considering reproductive activity later, they are told to bank their sperm before the radiation therapy because there's a very high chance of either temporary or permanent sterility following that. And so we weren't totally surprised to find this, but again, nobody had documented this. But it's not just white feathers and sperm, also lots of cases of tumors and other kinds of strange developmental abnormalities. Here's a nice bird with a really nice big thing. Again, fairly relatively high frequencies of these sorts of aberrations. Again, highly statistically significant dose-response relationship. The more radioactive, the more likely you are to observe these kinds of abnormalities. And there's the data. So I think just about everything I'm talking about today has been published, is in a paper that you can go to if you're at all interested. One of the first things that was noticed from the atomic bomb survivors was that many people were getting cataracts in their eyes, and even children. And we came to realize after that the cells of the lens in the eye are particularly sensitive to the effects of ionizing radiation. And so we decided to see what was happening in Chernobyl birds. And when we started looking at this, much to our surprise, it was very, very obvious. The birds from the more contaminated areas are much more likely to show a cataract in their eyes. We started looking at the rodents in both Chernobyl and Fukushima. And again, the rodents were showing much higher frequencies of cataracts in the more radioactive areas. Interestingly enough, this is the first data set. We've since added more. Females were much more likely to show a response to the radiation than were the males in these rodents. We think this may have to do with the fact that this is the reproductive season for the rodents, and the females are suffering from higher levels of oxidative stress than males, and this may be interacting with the radiation to lead to higher incidences of cataracts. We don't know for sure. It's a hypothesis. Another thing that was first noticed in atomic bomb survivors, actually it was noticed prior to this, for pregnant women who were treated with radium therapy and X-ray therapy in the 20s, 1920s, when they started using X-rays and radium to treat cancers, but some of the women were pregnant, and so they actually discovered first that these children of these women were much more likely to show microencephaly, smaller brains, and developmental problems. Also discovered in the atomic bomb survivors. So we started looking at the birds. And sure enough, birds from the more radioactive area had about 5% smaller brains. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it turns out that a bird with a 5% smaller brain has about a 50% lower chance of surviving from 1 year to the next, again suggesting that there are cognitive consequences of this effect. Again, not particularly surprising given what we've known of radiation effects from the medical literature, but again, surprising that we hadn't done any of this kind of research in Chernobyl. The rodents show the same kind of effect in both Chernobyl and in Fukushima. Smaller brains in the more radioactive areas. Essentially, everything we look at, sometimes the insects are a fun tool to use because they're easy to catch and they often have interesting patterns on their bodies, like this firebug. Do you guys have firebugs here? No, they're really cool. They're an invasive species, so undoubtedly you'll get them soon enough. But they're a really cool tool because, can you see this face mask kind of motif? I'll black that out there. See that? Well, we were walking around Pripyat. This is this town just outside of near the reactor that was built to house the engineers at Chernobyl. Walking through Pripyat one day, and Actually, we were collecting flowers for pollen, and my colleague, Anders, looked down on the ground, and there was one of these firebugs. And he pulls it up, and he goes, "Tim, look, this one's missing an eye." And I said, "Well, you know, sure enough." And so we started collecting them. And in that one day, we collected a whole bunch. I've put a few postcards out in the lobby if any of you want this picture, and of course we have it on the website if you want it. I thought it was just remarkable, how easy it was to capture the impact of radiation on development using this kind of a model. And somebody just get out, you know, if I need to get off the stage, just tell me and I'll wrap it up, because we do want to have time for discussion. Most of you, if you're following this discussion in Fukushima, then you've heard about the pale blue grass butterfly stories, right? How many of you have heard about that? Well, not so many. Okay. Well, there's not as many aficionados as I thought there'd be here. So the pale blue grass butterfly story was really interesting. A Japanese scientist had been collecting them anyway as a part of a study of climate change and of other environmental effects, and just by chance happened to be there collecting around the time of Fukushima, and sure enough showed that there were large impacts on the morphology of the butterfly wings as a result of the radiation. There were also cumulative effects that were passed down from one generation to the next. We also started seeing strange growth forms in the trees. These are pine trees from Chernobyl. Again, very, very strange growth forms, strange color changes. If any of you familiar with the Yablokov book on Chernobyl may recognize this from the cover. It's one of my photos, again, showing changes in the color and quality of the wood. Again, major impacts. Just this week, a paper published out of Japan showing similar consequences for the fir trees in around Fukushima in response to the radiation. So, bottom line, you know, when you start, we know there's lots of mutations, lots of genetic effects. We know there are tons of phenotypic consequences from very, very obvious to much more subtle, but absolutely no question of consequences, developmental consequences of this added mutational load. But does it matter? Does it really matter in terms of ecology? Does it matter in terms of the abundance and biodiversity of the organisms that are there? And that really has been, this has really been the main focus of a lot of our work. And we've taken kind of an unusual approach that hasn't really been done before. What we decided to do, because we don't know, we didn't know exactly how many critters were there before these disasters, right? You never have baseline data for these disasters. By definition, they're unpredictable. And so you have to come up with clever ways to generate predictions about what was there before so that you can compare that to what you see now. And so the way we've gotten at this is to do what I call, well, massively replicated biotic inventories, where we go to many, many places, count all the critters we see at that given location, and put that into a giant statistical model. In Chernobyl, we've gone to Ukraine and Belarus and looked at about 400 different locations a few times. In Fukushima, we've gone to 400 locations for 4 years now, and basically surveyed the range of critters at a range of radioactive contamination levels. And again, we put it into this kind of a model where we have our inventories, we have our measures of everything else that's important to the distribution and abundance of an organism, not just radiation. So, you know, bird distribution is determined by a lot of things, not just one thing. So if you're going to ask the question about radiation, you have to know the other factors that are also influencing their distribution. And then you have to have radiation measurements and GIS and some multivariate statistics. And using that, you can predict what should be in a given place in the absence of radiation. And this is what we've done, published a bunch of papers on it, including 3 papers on Fukushima birds just this spring. In Chernobyl, basically, abundances during the time period that we looked at it 10 years ago About one-third as many birds as there should be in the more highly contaminated areas, about half as many species. Fukushima, that's the one everybody's interested in. After 4 years of repeated sampling, this is what we find. Huge impacts, dramatically fewer birds in the areas of high radiation, many dramatically fewer species of birds as well. And do I have 2 minutes more? Okay, thank you. Just 2 minutes more. What I wanted to do was to show you what it sounds like. So this is an area that's relatively normal. Can you hear it? That's sort of typical. A couple of biologists counting birds in the background. All right. This is an area up the road, and this is not a scientific analysis, obviously, since we have sample size of one in both, but it reflects the two graphs I just showed you. This is a spot 15 miles up the road, very high radiation level in Fukushima. And since it was July, I think I'll have to go with Dave Vicente and call this a science silent summer effect as well. it's really a dead zone. There are no butterflies, no birds, very few. And it's very, very clearly the result of the radioactive contaminants. So what does this all mean? Contrary to those important reports by government agencies, there's clearly an abundance of information. It's not just our data that's showing that there are consequences of the levels of contamination that we see in Fukushima and Chernobyl. In other words, injuries to individuals, population, species, and even ecosystem functioning. I didn't have time to talk about today, but trust me, we've shown some interesting effects to decomposition and growth and that kind of thing, productivity. Long list of major findings. Again, you can go through them, but essentially mutations, phenotypic effects, reproductive effects, effects on longevity, everything that you would predict that radiation might do, it we can see in Chernobyl and Fukushima. So what are we going to do about it? We're hoping that we can mount a serious scientific effort to document a range of biological consequences, that we can document the range of relationships with different dose rates for these different organisms. We found tremendous variability among individuals and species in the responses, and some species have actually shown adaptive responses, positive responses, evolved adaptive responses. We need to know a lot more about what the constraints are. But this effort, needs to be conducted by independent scientists, scientists at universities or at research institutions that are not directly part of any governmental agency or any regulatory body. And why does it matter to you? You recognize this? Look at that. It's right there, right on the water. I hear there are 20 fault zones surrounding it. And then, of course, the other reason is it's coming. It is coming. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Timothy. That was wonderful. And now we're going to hear from Bing. Bing wants to make a very important announcement and talk to you.
Thanks, Mary Beth. This event, we had to pay rent for this space, and we put an ad into the paper. So I'm putting an appeal out. If you haven't contributed yet, we're going to pass a basket and a box. So we'd really appreciate some help helping with the expenses. The other thing I wanted to mention is that we were able to, in the past couple years, to monitor the site just outside of Tomales Bay. We have 7 samples so far sent to Woods Hole. We have 1 more sample that's paid for, so we'll have 2 years of sampling. But I think we really should get another year. So if you would like to contribute toward funding the monitoring off of Point Reyes Station, you can go to the website that Ken pointed out, rradioactiveocean.org, and then hit this button of help fund a location and scroll down to California and you'll see Point Reyes. And let's see here. Yeah, so we're working on our 9th sample. We have, you can see, $65. We have a little bit more to go to pay for this sample, but we would really like to get another year's sample. So that would be $550 a sample, so we need to raise about $2,200 to get another sample for every 3 months, so it'd be 4 more samples for another year of sampling. So if you'd like to get more data on this, because it, as Ken said, it'll eventually come down and hit us, and we should know the levels that we're looking at just off of Point Reyes here. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Mary Beth.
Thank you, Bing. I think that despair about all of these things is treated by action and taking positive action and doing what we can in our whatever our skill sets are and our motivation is really takes the feeling of despair away. I'm going to make a very short presentation here that wait a minute, where is the, oh, there, thank you. Right. And then we're going to have a conversation and questions and answers. I just wanted to say that, first of all, the reason we are concerned is because of all those bomb tests and the, not just Fukushima, but the bomb test that has left all the cesium in every part of the ocean, and likely future accidents. So we want to know how we can deal with this. We know that we did get measurable amounts of fallout from Fukushima because the UC Berkeley School of Nuclear Engineering was good enough to do some sampling and testing, and they did report that. And please do go to their site in their archives, and you can find this. We've got lists of how you can get more information about this more in depth on the table. So we appreciate very much that, see, that kind of testing is just so important. So that was that came across the ocean in 4 to 7 days and hit us and then went all the way around the planet. From it was detected in Iowa to Lithuania. So here's a graphic and from TEPCO, the operators of Fukushima, and looking at all of those on the left, those are tanks holding this wastewater that both Ken and Tim have talked about that flows through the corium, the melted cores, and becomes intensely radioactive. Then they put it into these hastily built tanks that are vulnerable to typhoons and earthquakes and corrosion, And it's practically inevitable that it will eventually all end up into the Pacific. So through bioaccumulation, which is the uptake of organic compounds directly from water or food, and then biomagnification, the sequence of processes that moves it up the food chain, this is what we're concerned with in the Pacific. As you know, the phytoplankton absorb the mineral-like radioactive isotopes eaten by the krill, which are then fed upon by the small fish, and the small fish eaten by the larger fish, and they are concentrated and reconcentrated all the way up to the top of the food chain where whales and humans consume them. Oh, what happened? Sorry. So there is at least one study that we know of that is being done to track this bioaccumulation in the Pacific Northwest. This is out of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Lava Gaba study. And we're really grateful that they're going to be doing this. And the purpose that they state is they want to be able to see when they can predict the point at which that the food web in the ocean will become toxic to the whales and to the humans who might be eating it. One company with integrity, Vital Choice, who sells wild seafood and canned, frozen, and makes fish supplements, is doing testing on fish. And they began in 2012, and after the fifth test, they did find one fish that was radioactive. It was a sockeye salmon. And it had, they didn't have any cesium in it. It was strontium-90, the equivalent to 65 becquerels. So this has already been mentioned about it. It's important. Japan limit is 100 becquerels per kilogram, and ours limit is 1,200 becquerels per kilogram. This is for cesium in food. And so we no doubt will be importing food that's too radioactive to be sold in Japan. And it's hard to tell when that is present because the country of origin labeling is being, it's stopping. I just wanted to also bring out that there is a scientific consensus on radiation risk, that there is no safe dose of radioactivity. And embryos, young girls, children, and women are the most vulnerable, although, and male children are more susceptible than adult males, but adult males, healthy young adult males, are what the standards are based on. And this has already been mentioned, but it's really a critical difference, the external exposure versus the internal, the ingested or inhaled. Once it's lodged in your body, it's much more apt to do harm and stay there for a long time. A lot of times people, you'll hear comparing radioactivity that's man-made with background radiation and or radioactivity that's man-made with naturally occurring radiation from thorium, you know, sands, and in a way that's meant to be dismissive, but they are all risks, and they should be added together rather than one eliminating the other. I wanted to bring up Dr. Yuri Banijevsky, who is the director of the Gomel Medical Student Institute in Belarus, and he discovered that the people in Belarus that he studied were actually affected very much by the radioactivity that they had absorbed and then passed down, the mutations passed down, just like the animal studies that are being done now by Tim. And they were then, the children were then much more vulnerable to small doses of cesium from their intake in the food and the water and the milk and so on. And these are very low levels, where heart disease began, 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram, and then 50 becquerels per kilogram, the permanent tissue organ damage. So in these areas that were most affected, they have death rates that are several times higher than the birth rate. I also wanted to bring out the, I didn't know that Tim was going to mention this study. Wasn't it you? Yeah, the dragons and disasters and dragon kings. This is, I won't take much time with that because Tim already spoke about this, but we know we're going to have another accident. And it's pretty, there are 400 operating reactors, 99 here in the U.S., but instead of taking steps to increase safety and lower risk, the governments are instead increasing the allowable levels of radioactivity because they want to continue with the industry. And for instance, the allowable exposure levels in Japan have been raised to what was formerly only for nuclear workers. They're pushing people to return to the contaminated areas, and they want to restart the reactors. Not the Japanese people, just the government wants to start the reactors in, if you probably noticed, active volcano areas. There's one that's just been started only 30 miles from an active volcano, and earthquake and typhoon vulnerable areas. And of course, in the U.S., we're not doing any monitoring at all. And we are, the NRC, extending the licenses for these aging reactors that weren't supposed to operate beyond 40 years to, they want to let them operate another 40. Radioactivity breaks down metal, cement, bolts in the reactors and in the facilities. They're crumbling, and they want to push them to another 40 years. And then the EPA protective action guidelines are being diminished. And then in Japan, mothers who are frantic about their concern for their children are being told, you have more to fear from fear itself, and just smile and it'll be okay. And also here in the U.S., there is an attempt to push the concept of hormesis, which means that a little radioactivity is good for you, and to make possibly change the standards. Tim has reassured me that will never happen, but I'm still nervous about it. So we're advocating pursuing the precautionary principle, here are some actions that we think that should be taken. We want to really underscore, help fund the independent scientific research, tell all your friends, all your billionaire friends, and join the citizen scientist radiation monitoring efforts. And I hope, Linda, you'll speak about that and what's happening in Petaluma in Sebastopol. And support the Japanese people in their extreme situation. It's just horrible what they're having to go through, all these refugees being pushed back into contaminated lands and their support being cut off after 2017. So, and also join the movement with us to shut down our own potential Fukushima Diablo Canyon. So. Thank you. And now we're going to go up to the chairs, and we'll be starting into conversation. But is this on? Okay. Well, just wanted to start the ball rolling, but then please be sure to, if you have a comment or a question, and please do keep them brief so we can keep time for everyone who wants to. Just go over by
being... Yeah, if you form a line over here if you have a question.
And Bing will hold the microphone, so in case anybody forgets to be brief. So, Ken, I'd like to start with you. Could you talk to us a little bit more about the phenomenon of the radioactivity of staying offshore and the currents that go along the shores? I'm fascinated by learning about these different currents. And were you aware of all of that? I mean, were the models accurate?
Well, again, what we know, and I'm not a physical oceanographer, that's not my primary area of study, is we know a lot about the main ocean currents, right? This Kuroshio and how it moves water quickly across. We know something about that through measurements with instruments that actually drift. When we were out in Japan in 2011, we dropped drifters over, you know, message in a bottle, but this is something now that talks to satellites. So we can see a lot of this happening. When you get to smaller and smaller scales, it gets harder, because the models don't have that resolution. And as we get to our coastlines, we deal more with influences of tides, small-scale physical forcing that makes it very difficult to predict from one day to the next what's happening. And when we have, I'm so proud and happy to have 100-something samples, but to really see something on those scales, you'd need thousands of those samples, and you'd need grids going at different times of the year or monitoring devices. We've thought about attaching things to autonomous vehicles so we could relate those specific currents that you can see with the satellite to the measured concentrations with a high enough frequency. So right now it's a bit hit or miss. I apologize in that sense, but that high temperature feature that I showed, that's the first time I've used that particular slide, seems to corroborate the fact that we're not mixing very quickly what's happening offshore, the warm blob, and what's happening onshore, a lot of upwelling cold water coming up. So the same processes are happening, but they're very unpredictable at this point.
Well, I think that's kind of good news, because the models that we were looking at earlier looked like, you know, we're going to be slammed with this stuff and be overwhelmed with it. And so I'm so happy, because I love the salmon. and I mean, the risk, I think it is sort of radiation roulette with the fish, but really, right now, it doesn't seem to be very concentrated. Dan, you've done a couple of measurements of fish.
Limited sampling, you know, just what people bring to us. And so far, it's been below detectable limits with our equipment.
Mm-hmm, which is below 10 becquerels, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to ask you, Tim, since you were seeing a 60% drop in survival, right? Or the 60% drop in
abundance.
In abundance.
Of the birds, yeah.
How do you explain that? Because that was how many years after Chernobyl? That was like 14 years, right, afterwards.
That was about 20 years after.
20 years, mm-hmm.
Yep.
So do you think this was a gradual thing, or how do you explain that there were any at all that kind of...
Yeah, no, I think, you know, given what we're seeing in Fukushima now, so the problem in Chernobyl, one of the challenges was that nobody was doing any measurements of critters really to speak of in Chernobyl following the disaster. So there's 5, 6, 7, 10 years really that are almost empty in terms of information. And so that was one of the reasons we were so keen to get into Fukushima as quickly as possible so that we could see what the initial responses of the biological communities would be. And what it's looking like is that there was an accumulative effect over multiple years where maybe we think we're seeing a sort of a steady state in Chernobyl right now in terms of the distribution and abundance of these different species. The reason I can say that is we were just back there this spring and actually repeated the same studies that we did 10 years ago. And so now we have a 10-year snapshot, a snapshot from 10 years later as to go along with it. In Fukushima, I think what we're seeing, or in Chernobyl, what we're seeing is a balance between the negative impacts on survival and reproduction and immigration coming in. So, you know, birds move, all animals disperse to some extent, and so we're having some sort of a balance between the losses of individuals due to lower reproductive rate, lower survival rates, and the influx of new individuals from adjacent areas that are uncontaminated, sustaining some of the populations. But it's really clear that for some species, like the barn swallows, there are definitely areas of near local extinction. They just don't come back, despite there being fairly reasonable habitat in every other regard. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the same thing happening in Fukushima.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have anything that they would like to ask? Oh, here we have a couple already. Okay. You want to?
Yeah, I have a pretty Richard Vaca, pretty simple question. In Fukushima, where you're seeing the areas where there's a relative absence of birds, is there also an absence of insects?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, and I'm glad you raised it because I didn't have time to cover it. So in the first year, in July 2011, we noticed that there was a near absence of butterflies, and the cicadas were also much lower numbers in the more radioactive areas. But we didn't see any obvious consequences for dragonflies and for bumblebees and a couple of the other groups. And another group that we've been monitoring are the spiders, which in Chernobyl, the spiders are much lower in the radioactive areas. In Fukushima, the spiders went up in the more radioactive areas. And of course, we suspected that this could be either due to an absence of predators. The number one predator on spiders are birds, or possibly because the prey are easier to catch in their webs, and so they're doing better. But I don't know if any of you have seen my New York Times video. It's on YouTube, and where we've started looking at the webs of the spiders, and there were some interesting studies done in the 70s, 80s, I think, with using different chemicals in spider webs and caffeine, and we've found that the spiders' webs in more radioactive areas are also much more irregular than in the cleaner areas. Right now we're just monitoring moths. We think that birds and butterflies are the most sensitive groups because they have a genetic system whereby the females are the heterogametic sex, what we call the heterogametic sex, the XY sex, the equivalent. In humans, males are XY, females are XX, and this added genetic redundancy of having two copies of the same chromosome means that if there's a mutation in one, the same gene on the other chromosome can take over, so to speak. But if a mutation pops up on the sex chromosome, like the Y chromosome in human males, it'll be expressed right away in that male. There's nothing to protect it from that mutation. And when it happens in a male, you know, it doesn't have a big effect on population growth rates because, frankly, males are replaceable. They just provide a little bit of genetic material. It's the females that are responsible for population growth. They produce the eggs and the offspring, and in most species, there's no male parental care. It's really about females. In birds and butterflies, females are the heterogametic sex. They have two different sex chromosomes, and so when a mutation pops up on that sex chromosome, we think that they become more vulnerable, if it's expressed, and reproductive rates are lowered as a consequence of that, and this is reflected in the reduced population sizes. It's a hypothesis. We have yet to test it. We're starting to test it with moths right now, which also have this kind of sex determining system. Lots of interesting questions. We just need to do more work before we'll really get at some of the answers.
Were you talking about Chernobyl?
Robert Manning. Since the reactor cores are supposedly not found, they don't know where they're at, and they're going to be producing highly radioactivity for, it seems to me like some of the elements will be for generations. It seems really pretty difficult. Joined with that is that they're creating tanks every day. I don't know how many tanks there are already. I haven't heard a number. I don't know how many are being created every day. More tanks, and as Mary Beth pointed out, they're really not that stable. It seems like a lot of craziness to me.
Yeah, I just read that one about every 3 days is built.
It's been almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's been almost 5 years next
right.
March.
Right, I don't, yeah.
If I can comment from the ocean side, there's over 1,000 tanks, and one of the hardest numbers to get is exactly the concentration of the isotopes and the amounts. It's not the volume that I care about, 300 tons. If the level is low, that's still not a high dose. What we've heard about are when there's accidental leaks. There have been a couple of these tank leaks. Mm-hmm. For cesium itself, the numbers are not that high because they can actively remove that source of contamination. But for strontium-90, one of my last slides, it remains quite high. So an individual tank leak can represent a significant fraction of what happened in 2011. We've done some calculations that there's more than 100 times the level of strontium-90 in those tanks than what was ever released 4.5 years ago. So we have some isotopes, but the character then it changes. It's not the cesium that concerns me. They have an active way to remove this. The engineers give them an idea they can do anything. They can take these isotopes out. It's never been done on this scale. They haven't shown that it's completely effective, and have been very hard to find real data about the effectiveness, something called the ALPS system, this removal system that's been designed and money has been spent on. But the other comment, this will go on for decades. It'll be very difficult to isolate these cores, things like ice dams and other engineering solutions, again, have not been shown to be effective. And so we are going to have continued leakage, whether it's from accidents or from what's coming out. Thankfully, again, there's always two sides to some of these things. The amounts today in those 300 tons is much less than what was going on before. And this is a number I want to get out there because it puts it in perspective a little bit, but it would take 5,000 years at the current level of cesium release, we're measuring it, to equal what happened in 2011. That doesn't mean today's release rate is tolerable, should be acceptable to people, but what happened 4.5 years ago is much, much worse. So we have a level today that we can understand and measure. We're monitoring it. It's not as severe for us in what's coming in the ocean as what happened 4.5 years ago. That's why I focus on that. Strontium-90, we're talking something like 30 years of current release to equal what happened before, or something happening with these tanks that actually have more strontium than was released. So that's why I'm kind of focusing more concern on strontium-90 than cesium.
Yes, my name is Ignacio Chapela, and I work at UC Berkeley as a microbial ecologist. I have 3 points. I'll be quick. First of all, to thank you, because this presentation was so beautifully rounded and complementary between the two of you. It was really great. and also to thank the people here who are able to pull off such a high quality event. So thank you very much, everyone. Secondly, I wanted to see if I could get a little bit more of an intentional review of bioaccumulation and bioconcentration. It's really interesting to see how you look at patterns of deposition and release, but then when you build in biology into it, all those patterns get translated in different ways. And if you add into it, like Tim was talking about, how you could translate radiation into heritable change at the community or the individual population levels, then it becomes really interesting. Last year, I participated in the World Soil Symposium or whatever, and there was a whole session on Fukushima. Hmm. And I was really astounded by the presentations, because they were practically all, except one, pretty much towing the official line, nothing to worry about. We went and looked at a few plants, nothing's happening. So I wonder if you guys have a different outlook on what's happening with plants, what's happening especially with microbes in the soil. I know with Chernobyl, there was a lot of work with mycologists showing that there was concentration in the fungal materials. So that would be the other one. The final one that I wanted to ask if you have a response on is about the politics of all this, because I really admire that you guys are doing this under such incredible circumstances. And doing citizen science is a great thing that is possible today. Yet, at the same time, and we should do more, and so nothing wrong with it. At the same time, doing it in a way is acknowledging that something is really, really broken with the system. I notice your maps of distribution and sampling are always around the edges where you're allowed to go, and there are fences when TEPCO should be inviting you to come in. So do you have suggestions on what to do about our scientific, public, and independent scientific system that is so compromised and so broken? Thank you.
Should I start?
I think we both need to talk on this one.
Yeah. Let me deal with microbial stuff. One of the experiments we ran in Chernobyl a few years ago was we put out litter bags filled with plant material to look at decomposition rates, and discovered that decomposition was significantly lower in the more radioactive areas. We'd love to do some more detailed microbial analyses of whether that was because the species composition changed or whether there was a direct effect on the physiology of the critters or what. We don't know. But this last year, we just put out, last fall, we put out the same sort of experiment in Fukushima, 600 bags filled with plant material that I'm actually going to Fukushima tomorrow. I'm heading to the airport, and we'll retrieve these bags that have been out for a year to see if we're seeing the same kinds of effects on decomposition, and that likely reflect changes in the microbial community. We're also collecting microbiomes, poops, from a wide variety of critters. It's widely believed that the microbiome has a large influence on the health of the host, and that radiation can influence the community distribution in the house. And so we're hoping, should funding become available, to be able to look in more detail at these microbial components that require expensive methods, expensive technologies, DNA sequencing technologies to really get at it. Well, I'll pass it to Ken.
Well, I wanted to touch on that last comment. What should the federal government be doing? What have we failed? And the crowdfunding model, the other thing I notice, it's clustered around San Francisco, Vancouver, LA, where there's people with money, right? So you don't get a valid research program going just taking samples where wealthy people happen to live. So we do need other sources of funding to get the type of data we've been trying to accumulate. And that requires often agencies, foundations, and grants. And particularly on the ocean side, what we would find early on is, we need to know something. So we go down to Washington and we'll talk to a Department of Energy who represents at high levels, who say, we have expertise in radioactivity, but it doesn't extend into salt water. They do underneath, waste sites, they do the cleanup, they do rivers, groundwater, Salty, you go next door to NOAA, National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration. We've been in their offices at the same levels, and they say this is great stuff, it's in the national interest, but we don't do radioactivity. We've been studying some of the debris fields, but not the radioactive part. What about EPA? And I think it corrects something I think you had on your slide. EPA does monitor air and drinking water, but not the oceans. FDA does some fish monitoring, food monitoring as well. Again, not the oceans. And so whether it's enough is something we can talk about. But we need to say we need this mission. Whether you're for or against nuclear power, someone needs to be able to monitor these same compounds, contaminants, in these oceans, and not just water, but ecosystems. Some of the same types of studies Tim's doing are not being done in the ocean. And that takes, in my case, research ships, hundreds of thousands of dollar grants. The first funding we had was from the Moore Foundation, a private foundation that got us to Japan with a ship full of people. That ship alone was $1.5 million. That project was $4 million. It sounds maybe high to you sitting here thinking about your checkbook and balance, but from a government agency standpoint, this isn't big money. This is not rocket science. You know, this is not military, obviously. It's small amounts of money to do the basic research at all levels, and that's just what's missing in the federal system right now. People won't take responsibility.
Dave DeSanti is my name. Just a simple question, Tim. What's the size of the area that's contaminated where you have still high enough levels of radioactivity around Chernobyl or around Fukushima that you see the effects that you do? I just don't have an idea of the scale of the...
Sure, yeah. Well, for Chernobyl, we're looking at about 2,000 square miles in Ukraine and Belarus, in that area. And what makes it ideal, and in Fukushima it's about a tenth of that. What makes it ideal, especially in Chernobyl, though, for ecological studies, is that it's really patchy. So you have an area of really high contamination, and then not too far away, you'll have a relatively clean area. In fact, you might have an area that's lower radioactivity than some of the black sand beaches around here, where there's natural thorium. And so we can do comparisons. And
what causes that so much heterogeneity?
Oh, so for Chernobyl, it was because there was the two events are very different in terms of how they occurred. The Chernobyl event followed a meltdown and a nuclear fire. So basically there was a nuclear reaction, fission ongoing, combined with the fire. It generated what people liken to a volcano in terms of the emission of radionuclides into the atmosphere. Apparently it was very beautiful, blue and green colors. They had the children from the local schools watching it from a couple miles away, and they got major doses. And because of the heat that was generated, it was injected into the atmosphere, into the higher atmosphere, and so it was carried. And it went on for 10 days. And so the wind direction changed, and depending on where there was precipitation, you ended up with deposition all over the place. So there was, you know, for a couple of days it was heading towards Scandinavia, a couple of other days it was heading towards Moscow, then it mysteriously stopped before it got to Moscow. Some people think they seeded the clouds over Belarus. It's conspiracy theory, I know, but it's so that's the main reason for the heterogeneity in Chernobyl. Fukushima is much less heterogeneous because there, first of all, there was only a couple of days where it was coming on land. Most of the time, it was blowing off to sea. For that 1 or 2 days where it was blowing on land, it was fairly steady wind and basically hit the mountains, and the mountains caused the uprising in the mountains caused. Basically, condensation of the radionuclides out of the air, and because it wasn't a heat event, it was just a hydrogen explosion. The emissions were not injected into the higher atmosphere, so they weren't carried nearly as far in the atmosphere, at least in that way.
Are there locations in North America where, from testing or anything, where there's still levels enough that one might be able to detect some of these effects?
Absolutely, And of course there are, first of all, we have, 70-odd nuclear power stations. And as far as I can tell, nobody has done any kind of significant ecological or genetical surveys around the power plants. Would require a little bit of effort to figure out where the effluents were being deposited, but they are being deposited, and there's likely some signature, biological signature. But then there's also all of the other facilities associated with the nuclear cycle. So the mining, so Arizona is littered with old mine sites that have tailings that are quite radioactive, and we know that there are health consequences associated with these mine tailings. And it's not just uranium mining, because often the ground associated with mining, if you're mining for tin in Nigeria, for instance, one of the slag that's created is from the other materials, the other minerals, highly radioactive, and gets into the food chain, affects the cows, affects the people. So yeah, there are many other places that this could be done. We're very interested in going to some of the naturally radioactive areas around the world. There are parts of the world that have been radioactive forever, the natural uranium sources, natural thorium sources, very large expanses in southern India, parts of Brazil, where the animals have been in contact with this radioactivity for eons, excuse the pun, and it would be really exciting to see what kind of adaptation, what kind of evolution is occurring in these areas.
Thank you, and thank you for what you've done here. It's great.
Yeah.
Where does that natural radiation come from?
Well, so if you dig down into the earth, everything's radioactive. there are vast expanses of uranium and thorium, both of which, and other things, Ken's more of an expert on this than I am, but they're these deposits come to the surface in many parts of the world, parts of southern India. Here in the U.S., there are uranium deposits that are more or less close to the surface. This is what leads to the radon in our basements, for instance, the breakdown of some of these natural elements. Natural radioactivity from radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in this country. So there's no doubt that radioactivity generates lots of cancers. There's no doubt about that. And so it's just surprising that we haven't investigated these relationships in greater detail.
I just wanted to add that fracking brings up a lot of radioactive materials, as does normal oil drilling.
Hi, my name's Lisa Miner, and I'm really interested in what you've seen with mutations. I've lived on the Big Island in Hawaii for the last 36 years and lived mostly outside. So I'm mostly outside. I'm very aware of the elements. I live on the island with the volcano, and where I live is where it rains a lot. And the last few years being there, I saw a lot of mutations. I saw a lot of new species. And when you said about spiders, it was like the year of spiders and the weird webs. And so that's very interesting what you say about mutations. I also noticed more growth with kale being unsymmetrical or doubles of things. And I have no education, I have no money, so but I would be really interested in participating and learning more about this. And I just want to thank you very much for being here.
I'd
like to know how I can find out about monitoring in Hawaii, the waters, and anything else there. I still have family living there, and I plan to go back there. And I grew up here, so it's really beautiful how much it's still the same here. And that it's because all of you are here paying attention and keeping it that way, because where I've lived over there has changed so radically, and it is such a unique habitat that has so many endemic species that invasive species and mutations, I wonder how much, like you said, the birds and certain things are more affected by the radiation, and other things maybe have more of the adaptation happens with more the imbalance I've seen. So yeah, I'm really interested in that.
Well, you know, I'm really open to doing research in Hawaii. So if anybody wants to send me to Hawaii, I'm happy to go there. As far, they have no nuclear power plants in Hawaii, which makes sense, you know, volcanic islands. But oh, they have some depleted uranium problems there? Oh, yeah. Great. Well, please send me there. I want to... No. No, you know, what your points are really important, and I've heard many similar kinds of accounts, as you might imagine. And my response often is there's probably... Unless we can, you know, we need to do the science, and you know, in fact, there was a woman here earlier with a highly deformed tomato, and you know, many of these kinds of mutations. So radiation is indiscriminate; it affects the entire genome, and so many of the mutations that we see as a result of radiation, we see naturally anyway. From other sources. And so it's really, you can't ask that tomato, are you the result of radiation or something else? And the same's true for tumors and cancers and cataracts. You know, if you smoke and you have radiation, you can't tell whether the cataract's the result of either one of those, for instance, as an example. And so you need to do the science, you need to replicate the study, you need to show that there's a repeated occurrence of these kinds of phenomena occurring. And that it could only be explained, or the best explanation is because of, well, in this case, Fukushima radiation effects, or is it something else that we hadn't noticed that's important in affecting these different systems? So just because somebody might say, well, you know, clearly that's not the result of Fukushima, doesn't mean you shouldn't pay attention to it. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't be looking for, you know, an answer to the question. It may not be what you expected, but until you put some effort into addressing the question, you're never not going to know.
Hi, I have two great questions. One is for Ken. Are there different, is a kind of radiation that comes through the air different than the type that comes over here through the water? And Tim, have you ever seen a Fukushima necklace?
Fukushima necklace?
I think the answer is no and yes. But no, yes and no.
I've got an ankle bracelet for you, not a Fukushima necklace. But the isotopes that were released in the atmosphere, iodine, also cesium, that came across very quickly in a few days, are the same ones that end up in the ocean primarily. There's some exceptions. Strontium-90 did not come atmospherically. So there's some differences in their expected source and if they came in that first atmospheric release or only into the ocean. So it depends on the isotopes. But generally, they're often very similar. The amount's much higher closer to Japan than what we saw. We detected Fukushima iodine and cesium about 10 days after the initial releases in Woods Hole, where I live. Levels were significantly lower than we had seen after Chernobyl in 86, and that had gone even further around the world. So detectable is something that we can do very readily for all these kinds of events, single tests, small amounts.
Thank you so much. The one quick question.
Go ahead. Yeah. The thyroid issue is the one that's come up, and of course it was the most obvious consequence of the Chernobyl disaster as well. 9,000 thyroid cancers, most of which were treated. And removed surgically or through radiation treatment. Interestingly, there's issues of secondary consequences of radiation therapy 20 years later that are occurring. In Japan right now, there are, you know, they've been monitoring very carefully the incidences of thyroid cancer in children, and you know, the first wave of analyses suggests that it's much higher than one would expect by chance alone. That the only likely explanation is a result of the iodine, radioactive iodine. But it's still a little early to say for sure.
Well, thank you so much. I think we're already quite a bit over time. I hate to cut this off. I have more questions too. But thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here, for coming all this way, and doing the work that you're doing under adverse circumstances. And we all need it and appreciate it very, very much. And thank you. Thank you.